Well, welcome to Hoboken Grace. I just want to echo what John said earlier. If today's your first time with us, we hope that you've just kind of made yourself at home today and jumped in with us. Right now, we're in the middle of a series or a conversation called More, and we've been talking about this idea of contentment. Contentment being defined as being completely satisfied or totally satisfied with who I am or what I have. It's different than maybe the way we usually think about contentment. And we've been talking about how, for many of us in our lives, this idea of contentment has become this idea that I would be okay, or I would be happy with being unsatisfied. What we want to do throughout this conversation is kind of call us back to that idea that you could actually be satisfied with who you are or what you have. And as we began this series, we looked at how when Jesus Christ steps into your life and my life, he kind of gives us this dream. And we looked at this passage where he's having this conversation with a woman, and he says, listen, if you allow me, I can do something in you that will become like a bubbling brook inside of you where you'll never ever thirst again. You could actually find contentment. And throughout this conversation, we've been looking at, okay, how does that happen? Because as he's talking to her about that, he says, you need to understand, it's not going to be found where you think it's found. It's not going to be found in the places where you usually look for it. It's going to be found in me. And last week, we looked at how in so many of our lives, our God, or this idea of God, is kind of one of many gods. And it was true with the woman that Jesus Christ was having that conversation with a couple weeks ago. But for all of us, this seems to be true, where we worship God, but he's one of many gods that we worship. And so last week we talked about, okay, how do we begin to have God become that center in our lives? How do we get to the point where we begin to eliminate those other things that we worship, whether it be relationship or our family or our career or our savings? And today we're going to continue this series and this conversation. And as we do that, what I want to do today is to give you a foundation upon which you'll be able to move forward and build upon throughout this year. Because for a lot of you, as we've walked through this, I've noticed this idea of contentment is something that you are keenly aware of. As a matter of fact, when we began this series, I wasn't exactly sure how many people would really grab onto this conversation. But as we've been talking about this, and as I've been having conversations with you and hearing the conversations that are coming out of the dinner groups, a lot of us are aware of the fact that we're unsatisfied. A lot of us are aware of the fact that the things that we think would satisfy us, the things that we thought would satisfy us, the things that we've been pursuing, that they're not satisfying us. And so as we've been having this conversation, for many of you, this has become a huge part of the internal conversation that's going on between you and God. And today what I want to do is I want to tell you this journey of contentment is not going to be something that we're going to solve in 3 weeks. But I want to give you the foundation, building upon what we've already talked about, that I believe will allow you to move into the rest of this year and into next year. And it will allow us to bring this conversation back into other conversations that we have, and you'll be able to build on this and begin to experience what Jesus Christ had promised us, that you could actually be satisfied, that you could actually find contentment. And so today what I want to do is I want to give you 3 things that I think you can build upon as you go into this year. And if you're with us for the first time today, inside your program there's a little notes card there. You can pull that out, and it's just a place for you to be able to jot down notes as we walk through this, and you can kind of take down these 3 things, and I hope that these are things that you'll revisit as we go throughout the next couple months and as we go throughout the next couple year, or as we go throughout the next year, so that you can begin to make this a reality in your life. Because the last thing I want is that we walk out of this series and we say, man, that's a great idea, but nothing actually changes. That we go back, or we fall back into this idea that idea of contentment is nice, but it's not actually reality. Because I believe Jesus Christ when he says to you and he says to me, I can satisfy you. And if you'll allow me, I can do something inside of you where you will never thirst again. Will you pray with me? Father, this morning, as we walk through this, I pray that what you've shared with us in your word, that this would become alive in us, that this would be something that we would take from here today, and we would begin to make these three things a constant practice in our lives, where we would evaluate these things in our lives over and over and over again so that we could discover what you came and gave your life for. That we could discover this experience of you where we're not just promised a better life one day, but where we experience life abundantly today. And that the world around us sees us and knows that our God is real and powerful because of the fact that he's satisfying us. And that we're able to move through life with a contentment that is unexplainable. In Jesus' name, amen. The first step that I want to share with you today is actually kind of comes directly out of our conversation from last week. And that step is bring everything to the altar. Last week, as we walked out of the conversation, we were talking about this idea of tearing out idols and removing those things from our lives that we worship above God. Those things where the truth is, you know, our safety, our security, it's not found in God. It's found in our career, or it's found in our savings account, or when it comes to comfort, that we don't actually find our comfort in God. We find it in that bottle of pills. We find it in that drink. We find it in all these other places. And we talked about how in our lives we have to begin to identify those idols, and then we have to begin to rip those things out. But we also talked about the fact that some of those idols you can't actually rip out. Right, my example that I used last week was my son, Caden, right? And we actually found out this week that we're going to have two sons. And everyone asked me, are you super excited? You know, because for the first one, I really, really wanted it to be a boy. And for the second one, you know, we were sitting there and the lady said, you know, do you want to know what it is? And we're like, sure. And I had kind of already seen the ultrasound, so I kind of knew already. And she said, it's a boy. And in my heart, I said, this is going to be tough. Because for me, my only experience with brothers is my cousins, and that was quite an experience, right? And there's all this fighting, and I was like, man, this is going to be intense. But it's awesome to be a part of it. And last week, I talked about how in my life, it's really easy for me to begin to worship my family. It's really easy for me to begin to worship Caden and my children and my wife and that, and to begin to find my security and my hope and my peace in them. And to begin to make the decisions that I'm making in my life completely about them. And as we talked through this last week, we said, well, what do we do about those things in our life that we just can't eliminate? I can't walk away from that. I have a responsibility to that. As a matter of fact, God tells me that I have a responsibility to that. So what do I do in those situations? I can't just walk away from my career. I understand that all too often in my career, I allow my career to be what makes me feel safe. Even though I have no control over it, I still allow it to be what makes me feel safe. I still allow myself to find my security there. So I can't just walk away from it. What do I do with it? And that's where we find this principle of bringing everything to the altar. Bringing everything to the altar means that literally you come to God, and with everything that you have in your life, you lay it before him and you say, okay, God, what do you want to do with this? How do you want me to handle this? God, I understand that what I have, the things that I have, my kids, my family, my wife, these aren't mine. There's an interesting book in the Bible called Job, and I'd love to be able to walk you through the whole story, but we just don't have time today. It is an intense story about this guy named Job and his interaction with God, and the whole story kind of starts out in a really interesting way. For me, it's like one of the most exciting beginnings of a story that there is in the Bible, because Job is this guy who is worshiping God. I mean, he is worshiping God more than anyone around him. So much so that Satan actually comes to God at this point and begins to have a conversation with God, and God begins to brag about Job. I mean, how cool is this, right? God actually begins to brag to Satan about Job. Like, you see my boy Job down there? You see how he worships me? You see how he loves me? You see the way he responds to me? Like, you may have gotten the people around him with your lies, but look at that guy, Job. How cool is that? How cool would it be that God would be like bragging about you and the way that you worship him, the way that you love him? And so Satan says to God, he says, yeah, whatever. The truth is, Job doesn't actually worship you. He worships the things that you give him. He comes to you so that he can get those other things. Exactly what we talked about last week, right? That so often in our lives we use God to be able to get what we actually worship. So I come to God so that he'll protect my family. I come to God so that I can get the promotion. And Satan says that's really what's happening in Job's life. I mean, if you begin to take some of these things away, he's going to turn on you in a second. And so God's like, okay, I believe in Job. Go ahead. Go ahead, Satan. Take some of those things away. And so Satan begins to do that. Satan takes away Job's family. Job doesn't turn away from God. Satan comes back, and they continue in this conversation. I mean, Satan takes away almost everything that Job has, and this conversation continues, and over again, God brags on this guy, Job. And he's like, yeah, Satan, you took those things away, and look, he still worships me. He still trusts me. His security isn't found in those things. And it's interesting because as this goes on, like, it's really cool for Job that God was bragging on him, but it becomes less cool with every single thing that he's losing, right? And he doesn't turn away from God, but he starts to get really frustrated with God. And he's like, God, I don't understand. And everyone around him thinks that he's just really screwed up, which is kind of the way that we look at things in church, right? That if bad things happen to you, then you must have made bad decisions. If bad things happen to you, then it must mean that you're not following God, that you're not trusting God. If anyone ever says that to you, just open them up to the book of Job. Because and that's what's happening in his life. All of his friends are like, oh no, you must not be paying attention to God because these bad things wouldn't be happening. But the truth is, the bad things were happening because God was so proud of Job. It's kind of an interesting twist. But as this whole thing begins to play out, it's interesting because Job begins to get really, really frustrated. And he begins to go before God and say, God, I don't understand. Why is this happening? Because he's asking the same questions that you and I ask. And as God answers him, it's interesting to see his response. Because one of the first things he calls him back to is this idea of bringing everything to the altar. It's found in Job 41, verse 11. It says, who has given me anything that I need to pay back? Everything under heaven is mine. He says, listen, Job, for you to understand this, we have to begin here. I don't owe anything to anyone. For some of us, this is like a life-changing concept because we live in the entitled generation, right? Do you guys realize this? Do you guys realize that this is how other generations talk about us? Right? For those of you who are in the younger generation here, right? Like, I'm like right on the line. I try to jump into the other, like the older one, so I don't get labeled with this, right? But for those of us who are in the younger age group, do you understand that if you talk to older generations about us, the number one word that they use to define the younger generation today is the word entitled? Right? Most of us live our lives that we're owed something, that we have rights to things. We use this terminology all the time. We use it when we're shopping like it's nobody's business. Right? And so, you know, and it doesn't really matter, guys, girls, whatever. Like, I'll be having a conversation with my friend on the golf course, and we'll be talking about new drivers, and he'll be like, well, dude, you deserve it. You deserve to be able to get a new golf club. I mean, look how hard you work. We use it all the time, this idea of entitlement. And so one of the first things that God does, he steps into Job's life, he says, listen, Job, let's start from the foundation here. And at the foundation, I don't owe anyone anything. I need to understand, everything that I have given you, I've given you. You haven't earned it. You have no right to it. It's all a gift. And when it comes to this idea of contentment, if we don't constantly evaluate this in our lives, if we don't over and over and over again bring everything to the altar, lay everything before God, it will be really, really easy for us to fall into the trap of entitlement. And you will not be content if you believe that God owes you something. As a matter of fact, you won't even be able to enjoy what he's given you. But when you begin to understand, okay, everything that I have, I bring it to the altar. And so on a consistent basis, I go before God and I say, okay, God, I understand you've entrusted me with this little guy. And you've given me this as a gift. But it's a gift. And that means it could be taken away at any time. I don't have a right to it. I'm not entitled to it. This family that I have, I don't have a right to this. I'm not entitled to this. You don't owe me this. This career that I have, I don't have a right to this career. I don't have a right to live in this house. I don't have a right to have a savings account at all. But God, you've given me this. And so you bring it to the altar and say, okay, God, what do you want to do with this? That's where this begins. The three things that have to be true in your life if this is going to become a reality is everything must become his. Everything must belong to him. And you must become a steward of it all. And everything that you have in your life, you view it as taking care of it temporarily. Which is reality, right? The truth is you have no control over these things. You have no control of when they're going to be given or when they're going to be taken away. And so in actuality, this is a step into reality. So that's where it begins. Number two is found in an interesting passage in the Old Testament. It's found in Exodus 28, 36 through 37. And I was reading through this book a couple weeks ago, and I found this passage, and it just blew me away, mainly because of the fact that of how it was applied in that day and age. But then it kind of began to impact me about how it should be applied in our day and age. It's found in Exodus 28, 36 through 37. It says, "Next, make a medallion of pure gold and engrave it like a seal with these words, 'Holy to the Lord.'" Let me give you a little bit of background on this. This is in the middle of them describing what the priests were going to wear for the nation of Israel, as they're putting things together for the tabernacle, this place where God is going to be worshipped, right? This place where God is going to be lifted most high. They say, okay, we're going to have priests as part of this. And those priests are going to have these robes, and it's giving this explanation of what these priests are going to be wearing and what they're going to be doing and how they're supposed to act and when they're supposed to act. And in the middle of describing what this priest is going to wear, we find this verse, and it says, listen, you're going to make this medallion of pure gold. You're going to engrave it with a seal with these words, "Holy to the Lord." Attach the medallion with a blue cord to the front of Aaron, who is the high priest, the top priest, where it must remain. So what he's saying, he said, okay, when you finish the priest's garment, right? He says, then I want you to make a medallion, this big medallion, and I want you to inscribe on it, "Holy to the Lord," and I want Aaron to walk around with it on his forehead all day long. And at first it kind of struck me because I was like, man, that must have looked weird. Right? And that's just odd. You're walking around with this giant thing. And for some of us, when we hear the word holy, we don't exactly understand it the way that we should understand it, because for a lot of us, we hear the word holy and we think perfect. And so this doesn't really make sense, right? Perfect to the Lord, that doesn't necessarily make sense. Holy doesn't actually mean perfect. Holy means to be set apart for something, right? And so we have this, for example, this next week is Thanksgiving, right? How many of you are like super pumped about Thanksgiving? Wow, are you serious? This is my favorite holiday of the year. That was like half of you. Like, how can you get better than this? It's like unlimited food and unlimited football. It is the highlight of my year. Right? And wow, that's disappointing. We're going to have to work on that. But I love Thanksgiving, and I've gotten more and more into Thanksgiving because there are all sorts of cool things that you can do cooking-wise around Thanksgiving, right? And I learned a couple of years ago that you can deep fry a turkey, which is awesome. The food tastes great, but that's not the best part. The best part is that you heat this giant thing of oil up to like ridiculous temperatures, and then you take your life into your own hands by putting this turkey into this deep fried oil, right? And I remember the first time that we did it, right? Me and my friend Marty were doing this, and we know that there are several people every year that burn down their houses doing this. We understand the danger involved in it. So we go down to my parents' basement, and there's all sorts of old coats, and we grew up on a farm, so there's like really like crazy like outdoor wear down there. And so we just start putting on layer after layer after layer, right? Like the idea that if somehow I catch on fire, the layers will protect me, which probably isn't true. It probably would have worked the opposite way, but we're putting on layer after layer, and we have on these gloves and all this stuff, and then we take this turkey, and we're like standing like this, trying to like slowly dip it down into this oil. It was awesome, right? And I love it. And this year, I'm really excited because I've expanded on our Thanksgiving tradition, and I've ordered my first turducken. Do you guys know what this is? Right? They take a hen, and they put it in a duck. And then they take a duck and they put it in a turkey. The whole thing. It is a solid chunk of meat. It's awesome. Right? I mean, how, you can't get any better than that. And not only that, I ordered it specifically from Louisiana because I wasn't messing around. Like, I wanted the real deal. Right? And then I discovered that you can actually have it where around each layer they stuff it with sausage. I was like, wow, this is a dream come true. And so we're expanding on that. But throughout that process, I've begun to develop a little kit. Right? And this kit is not allowed to be used at any other time in the year except for Thanksgiving. It's set apart for Thanksgiving. It's holy. And you laugh, but that's literally what it means. And so as Aaron's walking around, he's literally walking around with this medallion on his head that says, I am completely set apart. Everything that I am is only to be used for God. And it's interesting because God says, listen, if you're going to be a priest, if you're going to be my priest, then this is going to be what defines you. This is going to be the first thing that people see about you, that you are completely dedicated to me. That everything about you is set apart for me. And the interesting thing about that, you say, well, okay, I get that. That's for priests. But when you get to the New Testament, you find out that when we step into this relationship with Jesus Christ, the Bible tells us that we all become priests. As a matter of fact, Paul refers to us as a nation of priests. That you and I, every single one of us, are to be people who are holy to the Lord. And this process begins when I say, okay, I'm bringing everything to the altar. It continues. When we begin to live our lives and we begin to say, okay, how do I begin to operate in this world? Like there's a medallion on my forehead that says, holy to the Lord. That everything I do, every move that I make, every step that I take, it's dedicated to Him. And that in all of my life, He is to be what's lifted high. What would it look like? What would it look like to live your life in such a way that your coworkers would look at you and say, wow, that person is dedicated to God? And for some of you, you think that that means that you would look like a monk, right? That you would basically kind of take yourself out of civilization and you'd live in like this little one-room shack somewhere on the side of a river and you would just pray all the time. But that's not how Jesus lived his life. And Jesus was holy to the Lord, completely set apart, completely dedicated to God's mission. As a matter of fact, that's not how Paul lived his life. And Paul's one of the greatest examples that we have in the New Testament of what this looks like. And Paul had jobs, and Paul went, and Paul traveled, and all these different things. What would it look like in your life for you to be holy to the Lord? Three things. You must begin to see your role as a priest. This idea that I'm bringing God to the people around me, that I'm displaying God with my life. You must view your life as holy unto the Lord. Every minute, every choice, every activity, every conversation that I have is dedicated to God. And then the third one is found in a passage in 1 Thessalonians. It's a really small verse, but a verse that I think for a lot of us just shakes us up. We don't understand it. A lot of us look at it, we just kind of move past it. It just says simply this: pray without ceasing. Other versions say pray continually, never stop praying. And again, when we hear this idea that, okay, I would pray without ceasing, then for a lot of us, we think, okay, then I'm going to become a monk and I'm going to live in this monastery and I'm just going to spend my entire life praying. I'm never going to get off my knees. I'm never going to stop having this conversation with God. And that's kind of the picture that comes to your mind. And so this morning, I want to kind of change that picture because I want you to understand a little bit more of what Paul is trying to communicate here, because the first thing that comes into your mind should not be a monk. It should look something more like, have you ever seen junior hires when they begin a relationship? Maybe past junior high. Some junior hires don't actually talk to one another when they begin a relationship. So maybe senior hires, or maybe for those of you in college, like freshmen in college, right? Like, have you ever seen them when they start a relationship? Like, have you seen what that looks like on Facebook now? Right? Am I the only one who's seen this? Like, have you ever seen this? Raise of hands, right? Wow, we just have a totally unexperienced group of people here today. They never stop talking to one another. Like they're talking to one another in person, and then as they're walking away, they're texting one another. And then they get home, and they live on Facebook. And you say, what are you doing? I'm talking to my girlfriend. For 6 hours? Yeah. Are you crazy? Right? You've never seen this. None of you have seen this? Some of you have friends that are like this, and they're like 28, right? Come on. Let's be honest. Some of you have lived this. You're like, yeah, I remember when I did that. They're just obsessed with one another. They can't get enough of one another. They everything that happens, it's like they have to share it with the other person immediately. They don't even wait 2 seconds, right? It drives the people around them crazy, right? It makes the rest of us sick to our stomach. We're like, oh, dude, you got to stop. Please, stop. That's the picture that should come to your mind, because you see, the truth is, in our day and age, we can see it clearer than probably any other day and age. Because in our day and age, we have the ability to stay in constant contact. And for a lot of us, we do that. Maybe it's not with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, but maybe you have a really close friend where, everything that happens in your day, you're getting that on Facebook for your friends to be able to see. You're getting that on Twitter for your friends to be able to see. You're contacting or texting someone. Man, you wouldn't believe what happened to me today. That's what it looks like to pray without ceasing. It's this ongoing conversation in your head and in your life with your God, where all of a sudden he becomes your source of satisfaction. He becomes the one who you turn to for comfort. He becomes the one that you want to share everything with. And so in your life, before you text your friend, and sometimes when people are working through this, I'll kind of challenge people with this. And I'll say, well, you know, who do you text the most? And as I'm discipling people, I'll often ask them this question. Who do you text the most? Who do you call the most? What kind of social thing do you do the most? And they'll share that with me, and I'll say, well, here's my challenge to you. I want you to have a conversation with God about what you're about to share with that person before you share it with them. So before you go on Facebook to share this with all your friends, I want you to have a conversation with God about it. I said, and I guarantee you it's going to radically transform the relationship that you have with God. Because all of a sudden, he's going to become the one that you go to first. And this is with good things, bad things. But he has to become that person in our lives. And so as the writer of 1 Thessalonians is writing to these people, he's writing to them about all these things that need to change in their lives, and he's talking about how that can happen, and he says, but you have to pray without ceasing. God has to become your constant companion. Where you realize, and again, this isn't believing something that's far out there. This is just realizing what's true. God is with you all the time. It's just that for most of us, we ignore him. God's communicating and interacting with you all the time. And this is about realizing what is real and beginning to experience what is real. And so as we ask this question, okay, how do I begin to make God the one that I worship above all else? How do I begin, Jesus, to make you the one that satisfies me? As we move into this journey, and this is going to be a journey that we're going to continue down throughout this entire next year, something that we're going to jump back into in all sorts of different conversations. The foundation is this idea that over and over again, I'm coming to the altar and saying, okay, God, everything is yours. I am just taking care of this for a little while. Not only is everything that I have yours, but I am all yours. I am holy to the Lord. I am going to live my life in such a way that there may not be something on my forehead, but people around me are going to know it. Because I am dedicated entirely to you. And it's you that I'm going to turn to. You're the first person that I'm going to ask for advice. You're the first person I'm going to share that thing that I'm celebrating with. You're the first person that I'm going to cry with. You're the first person that I'm going to laugh with. This is the foundation. And when you do that, you begin to discover what Paul discovered in Philippians chapter 4. When he says, but I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. For most of my life, I read that passage, and I thought that Paul was saying, okay, if you want to be content, you pray to God, and he gives it to you. He gives you the strength to be happy when you're unsatisfied. He gives you the strength to be happy when you don't have what you need. He gives you the strength to be happy when everything is falling apart. But as I began to read through and I began to study this passage, I began to realize that that's not what Paul's saying. He's saying, I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I find myself. Because he's the one who sustains me. It's not that he gives me the strength to be happy in this situation or this situation. It's that he is my contentment. And so no matter what my outward circumstances are, I am satisfied in Him. It's His strength that satisfies me. And as you look towards this next year, I'm telling you, this is a journey worth walking with God. And if you'll take these things and you'll put these somewhere where over and over again you'll be able to remind yourself of them, and your experience of Him becomes more and more and more, you can find this. And you can begin to live your life in such a way that you are actually satisfied with who you are and what you have, because you are His and you have Him. Will you pray with me? Father, this morning, as we walk through this, this is a constant journey for us, because it's so easy for us to turn to those things around us. It's so easy for us to be distracted by all the things in our lives that offer security, that offer hope, that offer, but don't deliver. Father, I pray that this would be a place. I pray that we would be a group of people who are constantly reminding each other that not only that this is possible, but that this is the way to get there. I thank You. I thank You that You have not left us here, but that You are constantly moving us forward, constantly illuminating the path before us, and making our path straight. Father, we're all Yours. And may we be, as individuals and as a church, holy to the Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.